details, and I'll order all hands to the centrifuge. 20 minutes a day at half a G. Will that satisfy you?
No. It's 0.6 G down there in Rama, and I want a safety margin. Make it 3/4.
Ouch!
For 10 minutes, I'll settle for that. Twice a day.
Laura, you're a cruel, hard woman. But so be it. I'll break the news just before dinner. That should spoil a few appetites.
It was the first time Commander Norton had ever seen Carl Mercer slightly ill at ease. He had spent 15 minutes discussing the logistics problems in his usual competent manner, but something was obviously worrying him. His captain, who had a shrewd idea of what it was, waited patiently until he brought it out.
"Skipper," Mercer said, finally, "are you sure you should lead this party? If anything goes wrong, I'm considerably more expendable, and I've been farther inside Rama than anyone else, even if only by 50 meters.
"Granted, but it's time the commander led his troops, and we've decided that there's no greater risk on this trip than on the last. At the first sign of trouble, I'll be back up that stairway fast enough to qualify for the Lunar Olympics."
He waited for any further objections, but none came, though Mercer still looked unhappy. So he took pity on him and added gently, "And I bet Joe will beat me to the top." The big man relaxed, and a slow grin spread across his face.
"All the same, Bill, I wish you'd take someone else."
"I wanted one man who'd been down before, and we can't both go. As for Herr Dr. Professor Sergeant Myron, Laura says he's still 2 kilos overweight. Even shaving off that mustache didn't help."
"Who's your number three?"
"I still haven't decided. That depends on Laura."
"She wants to go herself."
"Who doesn't? But if she turns up at the top of her own fitness list, I'll be very suspicious."
As Mercer gathered his papers and launched himself out of the cabin, Norton felt a brief stab of envy. Almost all the crew, about 85% by his minimum estimate, had worked out some sort of emotional accommodation to their lives in space. He had known ships where the captain had done the same, but theirs was not his way. Though discipline aboard Endeavor was based largely on the mutual respect between highly trained and intelligent men and women, the commander needed something more to underline his position. His responsibility was unique and demanded a certain degree of isolation, even from his closest friends. Any liaison could be damaging to morale, for it was almost impossible to avoid charges of favoritism. For this reason, affairs spanning more than 2 degrees of rank were firmly discouraged. But apart from this, the only rule regulating shipboard sex was, "So long as you don't do it in the corridors and frighten the simps." There were 4 super chimps aboard Endeavor, though strictly speaking, the name was inaccurate, because the ship's non-human crew did not come from chimpanzee stock. In zero gravity, a prehensile tail is an enormous advantage, and all attempts to supply these to humans had turned into embarrassing failures. After equally unsatisfactory results with the great apes, the Super Chimpanzee Corporation had turned to the Monkey Kingdom. Blackie, Blondie, Goldie, and Brownie had family trees whose branches included the most intelligent of the old and new world monkeys, plus synthetic genes that had never existed in nature. Their rearing and education had probably cost as much as that of the average spaceman, and they were worth it. Each weighed less than 30 kilos and consumed only half the food and oxygen of a human being. But each could replace 2.75 men for housekeeping, elementary cooking, tool carrying, and dozens of other routine jobs. That 2.75 was the corporation's claim,
based on innumerable time and motion studies. The figure, though surprising and frequently challenged, appeared to be accurate, for simps were quite happy to work 15 hours a day and did not get bored by the most menial and repetitious tasks. So they freed human beings for human work, and on a spaceship, that was a matter of vital importance. Unlike the monkeys who were their nearest relatives, Endeavor's simps were docile, obedient, and uninquisitive. Being cloned, they were also sexless, which eliminated awkward behavioral problems. Carefully house-trained vegetarians, they were clean and didn't smell. They would have made perfect pets, except that nobody could possibly have afforded them. Despite these advantages, having simps on board involved certain problems. They had to have their own quarters, inevitably labeled the monkey house. Their little mess room was always spotless and was well equipped with TV, games equipment, and programmed teaching machines. To avoid accidents, they were absolutely forbidden to enter the ship's technical areas. The entrances to all these were color-coded in red, and the simps were conditioned so that it was psychologically impossible for them to pass these visual barriers. There was also a communications problem. Though they had an equivalent IQ of 60 and could understand several hundred words of English, they were unable to talk. It had proved impossible to give useful vocal cords to either apes or monkeys, and they therefore had to express themselves in sign language. The basic signs were obvious and easily learned, so that everyone on board ship could understand routine messages. But the only man who could speak fluent Simplish was their handler, Chief Steward McAndrews. It was a standing joke that Sergeant Ravi McAndrews looked rather like a simp, which was hardly an insult, for with their short, tinted pelts and graceful movements, they were very handsome animals. They were also affectionate, and everyone on board had his favorite. Norton's was the aptly named Goldie. But the warm relationship one could so easily establish with simps created another problem, often used as a powerful argument against their employment in space. Since they could be trained only for routine, low-grade tasks, they were worse than useless in an emergency. They could then be a danger to themselves and to their human companions. In particular, teaching them to use spacesuits had proved impossible, the concepts involved being quite beyond their understanding. No one liked to talk about it, but everybody knew what had to be done if a hull was breached or the order came to abandon ship. It had happened only once. Then, the simp handler had carried out his instructions more than adequately. He was found with his charges, killed by the same poison. Thereafter, the job of youthing was transferred to the chief medical officer, who, it was felt, would have less emotional involvement. Norton was thankful that this responsibility, at least, did not fall upon the captain's shoulders. He had known men he would have killed with far fewer qualms than Goldie. 12. The Stairway of the Gods. In the clear, cold atmosphere of Rama, the beam of the searchlight was completely invisible. 3 kilometers down from the central hub, the 100-meter-wide oval of light lay across a section of that colossal stairway. A brilliant oasis in the surrounding darkness, it was sweeping slowly toward the curved plain still 5 kilometers below, and in its center moved a trio of ant-like figures, casting long shadows before them. It had been, just as they had hoped and expected, a completely uneventful descent. They had paused briefly at the first platform, and Norton had walked a few 100 meters along the narrow, curving ledge before starting the slide down to the second level. Here they had discarded their oxygen gear and reveled in the strange luxury of being able to breathe without mechanical aids. Now they could explore in comfort, freed from the greatest danger that confronts a man in space, and forgetting all worries about suit integrity and oxygen reserve. By the time they had reached the fifth level, and there was only one more section to go, gravity had reached almost half its terrestrial value. Rama's centrifugal spin was at last exerting its real strength. They were surrendering themselves to the implacable force that rules every planet, and that can exert a merciless price for the smallest slip. It was still easy to go downward, but the thought of the return, up those thousands upon thousands of steps, was already beginning to prey upon their minds. The stairway had long ago ceased its vertiginous downward plunge and was now flattening out toward the horizontal. The gradient was now only about 1 in 5. At the beginning, it had been 5 in 1. Normal walking was now both physically and psychologically acceptable. Only the lowered gravity reminded them that they were not descending some great stairway on Earth. Norton had once visited the ruins of an Aztec temple, and the feelings he had then experienced now came echoing back to him, amplified 100 times. Here was the same sense of awe and mystery, and the sadness of the irrevocably vanished past. Yet the scale here was so much greater, both in time and in space, that the mind was unable to do it justice. After a while, it ceased to respond. Norton wondered if, sooner or later, he would take even Rama for granted. And there was another respect in which the parallel with terrestrial ruins failed completely. Rama was hundreds of times older than any structure that had survived on Earth, even the Great Pyramid. But everything looked absolutely new. There was no sign of wear and tear. Norton had puzzled over this a good deal, and had arrived at a tentative explanation. Everything that they had so far examined was part of an emergency backup system, seldom put to actual use. He could not imagine that the Ramans, unless they were physical fitness fanatics of the kind not uncommon on Earth, ever walked up and down this incredible stairway, or its two identical companions completing the invisible Y far above his head. Perhaps they had been required only during the actual construction of Rama, and had served no purpose since that distant day. That theory would do for the moment, yet it did not feel right. There was something wrong somewhere. They did not slide for the last kilometer, but went down the steps 2 at a time in long, gentle strides. This way, Norton decided, they would give more exercise to muscles that would soon have to be used. And so the end of the stairway came upon them almost unawares. Suddenly, there were no more steps, only a flat plain, dull gray, in the now weakening beam of the hub searchlight, fading away into the darkness a few 100 meters ahead. Norton looked back along the beam, toward its source, up on the axis, more than 8 kilometers away. He knew that Mercer would be watching through the telescope, so he waved to him cheerfully. "Captain here," he reported over the radio. "Everyone in fine shape, no problems. Proceeding as planned."
"Good," replied Mercer. "We'll be watching."
There was a brief silence, then a new voice cut in.
"This is the exec on board ship. Really, Skipper, this isn't good enough. You know the news services have been screaming at us for the last week. I don't expect deathless prose, but can't you do better than that?"
"I'll try," Norton said, chuckling.
"But remember, there's nothing to see yet.
It's like, well, being on a huge, darkened stage with a single spotlight. The first few hundred steps of the stairway rise out of it until they disappear into the darkness overhead. What we can see of the plane looks perfectly flat. The curvature's too small to be visible over this limited area. And that's about it.
Like to give any impressions?
Well, it's still very cold, below freezing, and we're glad of our thermostats. And quiet, of course. Quieter than anything I've ever known on Earth. Or in space, where there's always some background noise. Here, every sound is swallowed up. The space around us is so enormous that there aren't any echoes. It's weird, but I hope we'll get used to it.
Thanks, Skipper. Anyone else? Joe? Boris?
Joe Calvert, never at a loss for words, was happy to oblige.
I can't help thinking that this is the first time, ever, that we've been able to walk on another world, breathing its natural atmosphere, though I suppose natural is hardly the word you can apply to a place like this. Still, Rama must resemble the world of its builders. Our own spaceships are all miniature Earths. Two examples are damned poor statistics, but does this mean that all intelligent life forms are oxygen eaters? What we've seen of their work suggests that the Ramans were humanoid, though perhaps about 50% taller than we are. Wouldn't you agree, Boris?
Is Joe teasing Boris?
Norton asked himself.
I wonder how he's going to react.
To all his shipmates, Lieutenant Boris Rodrigo was something of an enigma. The quiet, dignified communications officer was popular with the rest of the crew, but he never entered fully into their activities and always seemed a little apart, marching to the music of a different drummer. As indeed he was, being a devout member of the Fifth Church of Christ, Cosmonaut. Norton had never been able to discover what had happened to the earlier four, and he was equally in the dark about the church's rituals and ceremonies. But the main tenet of its faith was well known. Its members believed that Jesus Christ was a visitor from space, and an entire theology had been constructed on that assumption. It was perhaps not surprising that an unusually high proportion of the church's devotees worked in space in some capacity or other. Invariably, they were efficient, conscientious, and absolutely reliable. They were universally respected and even liked, especially since they made no attempt to convert others. Yet there was also something slightly spooky about them. Norton could never understand how men with advanced scientific and technical training could possibly believe some of the things he had heard Cosmo Christers state as incontrovertible fact. As he waited for Boris to answer Joe's possibly loaded question, the commander had a sudden insight into his own hidden motives. He had chosen Rodrigo because he was physically fit, technically qualified, and completely dependable. At the same time, he wondered if some part of his mind had not selected the lieutenant out of an almost mischievous curiosity. How would a man with such religious beliefs react to the awesome reality of Rama? Suppose he encountered something that confounded his theology, or, for that matter, confirmed it. But Rodrigo, with his usual caution, refused to be drawn.
They were certainly oxygen breathers, and they could be humanoid. But let's wait and see. With any luck, we should discover what they were like. There may be pictures, statues, perhaps even bodies over in those towns. If they are towns.
And the nearest is only 8 kilometers away, said Calvert, hopefully.
Yes, thought Norton, but it's also 8 kilometers back, and then there's that overwhelming stairway to climb again. Can we take the risk?
A quick sortie to the town they had named Paris had been among the first of his contingency plans, and now he had to make his decision. They had ample food and water for a stay of 24 hours. They would always be in full view of the backup team on the hub, and any kind of accident seemed virtually impossible on this smooth, gently curving metal plane. The only foreseeable danger was exhaustion. When they got to Paris, which they could do easily enough, could they do more than take a few photographs and perhaps collect some small artifacts before they had to return? But even such a brief foray would be worth it. There was so little time as Rama hurtled sunward toward a perihelion too dangerous for Endeavor to match. In any case, part of the decision was not his to make. Up in the ship, Dr. Ernst would be watching the outputs of the biotelemetering sensors attached to his body. If she turned thumbs down, that would be that. Laura, what do you think?
Take 30 minutes rest and a 500-calorie energy module. Then you can start.
Thanks, Doc, interjected Calvert. Now I can die happy. I always wanted to see Paris. Montmartre, here we come. 13. The Plain of Rama. After those interminable stairs, it was a strange luxury to walk once more on a horizontal surface. Directly ahead, the ground was indeed completely flat. To right and left, at the limits of the floodlit area, the rising curve could just be detected. They might have been walking along a very wide, shallow valley. It was quite impossible to believe that they were really crawling along the inside of a huge cylinder, and that beyond this little oasis of light, the land rose up to meet, no, to become the sky. Though they all felt a sense of confidence and subdued excitement, after a while, the almost palpable silence of Rama began to weigh heavily upon them. Every footstep, every word, vanished instantly into the unreverberant void. After they had gone little more than half a kilometer, Joe Calvert could stand it no longer. Among his minor accomplishments was a talent now rare, though many thought not rare enough, the art of whistling. With or without encouragement, he could reproduce the themes from most of the movies of the last 200 years. He started appropriately with, "Hi-ho, hi-ho, it's off to work we go," found that he couldn't stay down comfortably in the bass with Disney's Marching Dwarfs, and switched quickly to the River Kwai song. Then he progressed, more or less chronologically, through half a dozen epics, culminating with the theme from Sid Craftman's famous late 20th century Napoleon. It was a good try, but it didn't work, even as a morale builder. Rama needed the grandeur of Bach, or Beethoven, or Sibelius, or Tuan Sun, not the trivia of popular entertainment. Norton was on the point of suggesting that Joe save his breath for later exertions when the young officer realized the inappropriateness of his efforts. Thereafter, apart from an occasional consultation with the ship, they marched on in silence. Rama had won this round. On this initial traverse, Norton had allowed for one detour. Paris lay straight ahead, halfway between the foot of the stairway and the shore of the cylindrical sea, but only a kilometer to the right of their track was a very prominent and rather mysterious feature, which had been christened the Strait Valley. It was a long groove or trench, 40 meters deep and 100 wide, with gently sloping sides. It had been provisionally identified as an irrigation ditch or canal. Like the stairway, it had two similar counterparts, equally spaced on the curve of Rama. The three valleys were almost 10 kilometers long, and they stopped abruptly just before they reached the sea, which was strange if they were intended to carry water. And on the other side of the sea, the pattern was repeated. Three more 10-kilometer trenches continued on to the region of the South Pole. They reached the near end of the Strait Valley after only 15 minutes comfortable walking, and stood for a while, staring thoughtfully into its depths. The perfectly smooth walls sloped down at an angle of 60 degrees. There were no steps or footholds. Filling the bottom was a sheet of flat, white material that looked much like ice. A specimen could settle a good many arguments. Norton decided to get one. With Calvert and Rodrigo acting as anchors and playing out a safety rope, he rappelled slowly down the steep incline. When he reached the bottom, he fully expected to find the familiar, slippery feel of ice underfoot, but he was mistaken. The friction was too great. His footing was secure. This material was some kind of glass or transparent crystal. When he touched it with his fingertips, it was cold, hard, and unyielding. Turning his back to the searchlight and shielding his eyes from its glare, Norton tried to peer into the crystalline depths, as one may attempt to gaze through the ice of a frozen lake. But he could see nothing. Even when he tried the concentrated beam of his own helmet lamp, he was no more successful. This stuff was translucent, but not transparent. If it was a frozen liquid, it had a melting point much higher than water. He tapped it gently with the hammer from his geology kit. The tool rebounded with a dull, unmusical clunk. He tapped harder, with no more result, and he was about to exert his full strength when some impulse made him desist. It seemed most unlikely that he could crack this material, but what if he did? He would be like a vandal, smashing some enormous plate glass window. There would be a better opportunity later, and at least he had discovered valuable information. It now seemed most unlikely that this was a canal. It was simply a peculiar trench that stopped and started abruptly, but led nowhere. And if at any time it had carried liquid, where were the stains, the encrustations of dried-up sediment that one would expect? Everything was bright and clean, as if the builders had left only yesterday. Once again, he was face to face with the fundamental mystery of Rama, and this time it was impossible to evade it. Norton was a reasonably imaginative man, but he would never have reached his present position if he had been liable to the wilder flights of fancy. Yet now, for the first time, he had a sense, not exactly of foreboding, but of anticipation. Things were not what they seemed. There was something very odd indeed about a place that was simultaneously brand new and a million years old. Deep in thought, he began to walk slowly along the length of the little valley, while his companions, still holding the rope that was attached to his waist, followed him along the rim. He did not expect to make any further discoveries, but he wanted to let his curious, emotional state run its course. For something else was worrying him, and it had nothing to do with the inexplicable newness of Rama. He had walked no more than a dozen meters when it hit him like a thunderbolt. He knew this place. He had been here before. Even on Earth, or on some familiar planet, that experience is disquieting, though it is not particularly rare. Most men have known it at some time or other, and usually they dismiss it as the memory of a forgotten photograph, a pure coincidence, or, if they are mystically inclined, some form of telepathy from another mind, or even a flashback from their own future. But to recognize a spot that no other human being can possibly have seen, that is quite shocking. For several seconds, Norton stood rooted to the smooth, crystalline surface on which he had been walking, trying to straighten out his feelings. His well-ordered universe had been turned upside down, and he had a dizzying glimpse of those mysteries at the edge of existence that he had successfully ignored for most of his life. Then, to his immense relief, common sense came to the rescue. The disturbing sensation of déjà vu faded out, to be replaced by a real and identifiable memory from his youth. It was true. He had once stood between such steeply sloping walls, watching them drive into the distance until they seemed to converge at a point indefinitely far ahead. But they had been covered with neatly trimmed grass, and underfoot had been broken stone, not smooth crystal. It had happened 30 years ago, during a summer vacation in England, largely because of another student. He could remember her face, but he had forgotten her name. He had taken a course in industrial archaeology, then very popular among science and engineering graduates. They had explored abandoned coal mines and cotton mills, climbed over ruined blast furnaces and steam engines, goggled unbelievingly at primitive, and still dangerous, nuclear reactors, and driven priceless turbine-powered antiques along restored motor roads. Not everything that they saw was genuine. Much had been lost during the centuries, for men seldom bothered to preserve the commonplace articles of everyday life. But where it was necessary to make copies, they had been reconstructed with loving care. And so, young Bill Norton had found himself bowling along at an exhilarating 100 kilometers an hour, while he furiously shoveled precious coal into the firebox of a locomotive that looked 200 years old, but was actually younger than he was. The 30-kilometer stretch of the Great Western Railway, however, was quite genuine, though it had required a good deal of excavating to get it back into commission. With whistle screaming, they had plunged into a hillside and raced through a smoky, flame-lit darkness. An astonishingly long time later, they had burst out of the tunnel into a deep, perfectly straight cutting between steep, grassy banks. The long-forgotten vista was almost identical with the one before him now.
"What is it, Skipper?" called Rodrigo. "Have you found something?"
As Norton dragged himself back to present reality, some of the oppression lifted from his mind. There was mystery here, yes, but it might not be beyond human understanding. He had learned a lesson, though it was not one that he could readily impart to others. At all costs, he must not let Rama overwhelm him. That way lay failure, perhaps even madness.
"No," he answered. "There's nothing down here. Haul me up. We'll head straight to Paris."
14. Storm Warning.
"I've called this meeting of the committee," said His Excellency the Ambassador from Mars to the United Planets, "because Dr. Pereira has something important to tell us. He insists that we get in touch with Commander Norton right away, using the priority channel we've been able to establish, after, I might say, a good deal of difficulty. Dr. Pereira's statement is rather technical, and before we come to it, I think a summary of the present position might be in order. Dr. Price has prepared one. Oh, yes, some apologies for absence. Sir Lewis Sands has had to leave for Earth for a conference he's chairing, and Dr. Taylor asked to be excused.
He was rather pleased about that last absence.
The anthropologist had rapidly lost interest in Rama when it became obvious that it would present little scope for him. Like many others, he had been bitterly disappointed to learn that the mobile worldlet was dead. Now there would be no opportunity for sensational books and vidis about Raman rituals and behavioral patterns. Others might dig up skeletons and classify artifacts, but that sort of thing did not appeal to Conrad Taylor. Perhaps the only discovery that would bring him back in a hurry would be some highly explicit works of art, like the notorious frescoes of Thera and Pompeii. Thelma Price took exactly the opposite point of view. She preferred excavations and ruins uncluttered by inhabitants who might interfere with dispassionate scientific studies. The bed of the Mediterranean had been ideal, at least until the city planners and landscape artists had started getting in the way. And Rama would have been perfect, except for the maddening detail that it was 100 million kilometers away, and she would never be able to visit it in person.
"As you all know," she began, "Commander Norton has completed one traverse of almost 30 kilometers without encountering any problems. He explored the curious trench shown on your maps as the Strait Valley. Its purpose is still quite unknown, but it is clearly important because it runs the full length of Rama, except for the break at the Cylindrical Sea. And there are two identical structures 120 degrees apart on the circumference of the world. Next, the party turned left, or east if we adopt the North Pole Convention, until they reached Paris. As you'll see from this photograph, taken by a telescopic camera at the hub, it is a group of several hundred buildings, with wide streets between them. Now, these photographs were taken by Commander Norton's group when they reached the site. If Paris is a city, it is a most peculiar one. Note that none of the buildings have windows or even doors. They are all plain, rectangular structures, an identical 35 meters high, and they appear to have been extruded from the ground. There are no seams or joints. Look at this close-up of the base of a wall. There's a smooth transition into the ground. My own feeling is that this place is not a residential area, but a storage or supply depot. In support of that theory, look at this photo. These narrow slots or grooves, about 5 centimeters wide, run along all the streets, and there is one leading to every building, going straight into the wall. There is a striking resemblance to the streetcar tracks of the early 20th century. They are obviously part of some transport system. We've never considered it necessary to have public transport direct to every house. It would be economically absurd. People can always walk a few hundred meters. But if these buildings are being used for the storage of heavy materials, it would make sense.
May I ask a question? Said the ambassador from Earth.
Of course, Sir Robert.
Commander Norton couldn't get into a single building.
No. When you listen to his report, you can tell he was quite frustrated. At one time, he decided that the buildings could be entered only from underground. Then he discovered the grooves of the transport system and changed his mind.
Did he try to break in?
There was no way he could, without explosives or heavy tools. And he doesn't want to do that until all other approaches have failed.
I have it,
Dennis Solomons suddenly interjected.
Cocooning,
I beg your pardon?
It's a technique developed a couple of hundred years ago, continued the science historian. Another name for it is mothballing. When you have something you want to preserve, you seal it inside a plastic envelope and then pump in an inert gas. The original use was to protect military equipment between wars. It was once applied to whole ships. It's still widely used in museums that are short of storage space. No one knows what's inside some of the 100-year-old cocoons in the Smithsonian basement.
Patience was not one of Pereira's virtues. He was aching to drop his bombshell, and could restrain himself no longer.
Please, Mr. Ambassador, this is all very interesting, but I feel my information is rather more urgent.
If there are no other points, very well, Dr. Pereira. The exobiologist, unlike Taylor, had not found Rama a disappointment. It was true that he no longer expected to find life, but sooner or later, he felt quite sure some remains would be discovered of the creatures who had built this fantastic world. Exploration had barely begun, although the time available was horribly brief before Endeavor would be forced to escape from her present sun-grazing orbit. But now, if his calculations were correct, man's contact with Rama would be even shorter than he had feared. One detail had been overlooked, because it was so large that no one had noticed it before.
According to our latest information, Pereira began, one party is now on its way to the Cylindrical Sea, while Commander Norton has another group setting up a supply base at the foot of Stairway Alpha. When that's established, he intends to have at least two exploratory missions operating at all times. In this way, he hopes to use his limited manpower at maximum efficiency. It's a good plan, but there may be no time to carry it out. In fact, I would advise an immediate alert and a preparation for total withdrawal at 12 hours' notice. Let me explain. It is surprising how few people have commented on a rather obvious anomaly about Rama. It is now well inside the orbit of Venus, yet the interior is still frozen, and the temperature of an object in direct sunlight at this point is about 500 degrees. The reason, of course, is that Rama has not had time to warm up. It must have cooled down to near absolute zero, 270 degrees below, while it was in interstellar space. Now, as it approaches the sun, the outer hull is already almost as hot as molten lead. But the inside will stay cold until the heat works its way through that kilometer of rock. There's some kind of fancy dessert with a hot exterior and ice cream in the middle. I don't remember what it's called.
Baked Alaska. It's a favorite at UP banquets, unfortunately.
Thank you, Sir Robert. That's the situation in Rama at the moment, but it won't last. All these weeks, the solar heat has been working its way through, and we can expect a sharp temperature rise to begin in a few hours. That's not the problem, however. By the time we'll have to leave anyway, it will be no more than comfortably tropical.
Then, what's the difficulty?
I can answer in one word, Mr. Ambassador. Hurricanes.
15. The Edge of the Sea. There were now more than 20 men and women inside Rama, 6 of them down on the plane, the rest ferrying equipment and expendables through the airlock system and down the stairway. The ship itself was almost deserted, with the minimum possible staff on duty. The joke went around that Endeavor was really being run by the four simps, and that Goldie had been given the rank of acting commander. For these first explorations,
Norton had established a number of ground rules. The most important dated back to the earliest days of man's spacefaring. Every group, he had decided, must contain one person with prior experience, but not more than one. In that way, everybody would have an opportunity to learn as quickly as possible. And so, the first party to head for the cylindrical sea, though it was led by Surgeon Commander Laura Ernst, had as its one-time veteran Boris Rodrigo, just back from Paris. The third member, Sergeant Peter Rousseau, had been with the backup teams at the hub. He was an expert on space reconnaissance instrumentation, but on this trip he would have to depend on his own eyes and a small portable telescope. From the foot of Stairway Alpha to the edge of the sea was just under 15 kilometers, or an Earth equivalent of 8 under the low gravity of Rama. Laura Ernst, who had to prove that she lived up to her own standards, set a brisk pace. They stopped for 30 minutes at the midway mark and made the whole trip in a completely uneventful 3 hours. It was also quite monotonous, walking forward in the beam of the searchlight through the anechoic darkness of Rama. As the pool of light advanced with them, it slowly elongated into a long, narrow ellipse. This foreshortening of the beam was the only visible sign of progress. If the observers up on the hub had not given them continual distance checks, they could not have guessed whether they had traveled 1 kilometer or 5 or 10. They just plodded onward through the million-year-old night, over an apparently seamless metal surface. But at last, far ahead, at the limits of the now weakening beam, there was something new. On a normal world, it would have been a horizon. As they approached, they could see that the plane on which they were walking came to an abrupt stop. They were nearing the edge of the sea. "Only 100 meters," said Hub Control. "Better slow down." That was hardly necessary, yet they had already done so. From the level of the plain to that of the sea, if it was a sea and not another sheet of that mysterious crystalline material, was a sheer straight drop of 50 meters. Although Norton had impressed upon everyone the danger of taking anything for granted in Rama, few doubted that the sea was really made of ice. But for what conceivable reason was the cliff on the southern shore 500 meters high, instead of the 50 here? It was as if they were approaching the edge of the world. Their oval of light, cut off abruptly ahead of them, became shorter and shorter. But far out on the curved screen of the sea, their monstrous foreshortened shadows had appeared, magnifying and exaggerating every movement. Those shadows had been their companions every step of the way as they marched down the beam, but now that they were broken at the edge of the cliff, they no longer seemed part of them. They might have been creatures of the cylindrical sea, waiting to deal with any intruders into their domain. Because they were now standing on the edge of a 50-meter cliff, it was possible for the first time to appreciate the curvature of Rama. But no one had ever seen a frozen lake bent upward into a cylindrical surface. That was distinctly unsettling, and the eye did its best to find some other interpretation. It seemed to Dr. Ernst, who had once made a study of visual illusions, that half the time she was really looking at a horizontally curving bay, not a surface that soared up into the sky. It required a deliberate effort of will to accept the fantastic truth. Only in the line directly ahead, parallel to the axis of Rama, was normality preserved. In this direction alone was there agreement between vision and logic. Here, for the next few kilometers at least, Rama looked flat, and was flat.
And out there, beyond their distorted shadows and the outer limit of the beam, lay the island that dominated the cylindrical sea.
Hub control, Dr. Ernst radioed. Please aim your beam at New York.
The night of Rama fell suddenly upon them as the oval of light went sliding out to sea. Conscious of the now invisible cliff at their feet, they all stepped back a few meters. Then, as if by some magical stage transformation, the towers of New York sprang into view. The resemblance to old-time Manhattan was only superficial. This star-born echo of Earth's past possessed its own unique identity. The more Dr. Ernst stared at it, the more certain she became that it was not a city at all. The real New York, like all of man's habitations, had never been finished. Still less had it been designed. This place, however, had an overall symmetry and pattern, though one so complex that it eluded the mind. It had been conceived and planned by some controlling intelligence, and then it had been completed like a machine devised for some specific purpose. After that, there was no possibility of growth or change. The beam of the searchlight slowly tracked along those distant towers and domes and interlocked spheres and crisscrossed tubes. Sometimes there was a brilliant reflection as some flat surface shot the light back toward them. The first time this happened, they were all taken by surprise. It was exactly as if, over there on that strange island, someone was signaling to them. But there was nothing that they could see here that was not already shown in greater detail on photographs taken from the hub. After a few minutes, they called for the light to return to them and began to walk eastward along the edge of the cliff. It had been plausibly theorized that somewhere there must surely be a flight of steps or a ramp leading down to the sea. And one crewman, who was a keen sailor, had raised an interesting conjecture. Where there's a sea, Sergeant Ruby Barnes had predicted, there must be docks and harbors and ships. You can learn everything about a culture by studying the way it builds boats. Her colleagues thought this a rather restricted point of view, but at least it was a stimulating one. Dr. Ernst had almost given up the search and was preparing to make a descent by rope when Rodrigo spotted the narrow stairway. It could easily have been overlooked in the shadowed darkness below the edge of the cliff, for there was no guardrail or other indication of its presence, and it seemed to lead nowhere. It ran down the 50-meter vertical wall at a steep angle and disappeared below the surface of the sea. They scanned the flight of steps with their helmet lights, could see no conceivable hazard, and Dr. Ernst got Commander Norton's permission to descend. A minute later, she was cautiously testing the surface of the sea. Her foot slithered almost frictionlessly back and forth. The material felt exactly like ice. It was ice. When she struck it with her hammer, a familiar pattern of cracks radiated from the impact point, and she had no difficulty in collecting as many pieces as she wished. Some had already melted when she held up the sample holder to the light. The liquid appeared to be slightly turbid water, and she took a cautious sniff.
"Is that safe?" Rodrigo called down, with a trace of anxiety.
"Believe me, Boris," she answered. "If there are any pathogens around here that have slipped through my detectors, our insurance policies lapsed a week ago." But Rodrigo had a point. Despite all the tests that had been carried out, there was a slight risk that this substance might be poisonous, or might carry some unknown disease. In normal circumstances, Dr. Ernst would not have taken even this minuscule chance. Now, however, time was short, and the stakes were enormous. If it became necessary to quarantine Endeavor, that would be a small price to pay for her cargo of knowledge.
It's water, but I wouldn't care to drink it. It smells like an algae culture that's gone bad. I can hardly wait to get it to the lab.
Is the ice safe to walk on?
Yes, solid as a rock.
Then we can get to New York.
Can we, Peter? Have you ever tried to walk across 4 kilometers of ice?
Oh, I see what you mean. Just imagine what stores would say if we asked for a set of skates. Not that many of us would know how to use them, even if we had any aboard.
And there's another problem, put in Rodrigo. Do you realize that the temperature is already above freezing? Before long, that ice is going to melt. How many spacemen can swim 4 kilometers? Certainly not this one.
Dr. Ernst rejoined them at the edge of the cliff and held up the small sample bottle in triumph.
It's a long walk for a few cc's of dirty water, but it may teach us more about Rama than anything we've found so far. Let's head for home.
They turned toward the distant lights of the hub, moving with the gentle, loping strides that had proved the most comfortable means of walking under this reduced gravity. Often they looked back, drawn by the hidden enigma of the island out there in the center of the frozen sea. And just once, Dr. Ernst thought she felt the faint suspicion of a breeze against her cheek. It did not come again, and she quickly forgot about it.
16. Kialakekua.
As you know perfectly well, Dr. Pereira, said Ambassador Bowes in a tone of patient resignation, few of us share your knowledge of mathematical meteorology, so please take pity on our ignorance.
With pleasure, answered the exobiologist, quite unabashed. I can explain it best by telling you what is going to happen inside Rama very soon. The temperature is now about to rise as the solar heat pulse reaches the interior. According to the latest information I've received, it is already above freezing point. The cylindrical sea will soon start to thaw, and unlike bodies of water on Earth, it will melt from the bottom upward. That may produce some odd effects, but I'm much more concerned with the atmosphere. As it is heated, the air inside Rama will expand and will attempt to rise toward the central axis. And this is the problem. At ground level, although it is apparently stationary, it is actually sharing the spin of Rama, over 800 kilometers an hour. As it rises toward the axis, it will try to retain that speed. And it won't be able to do so, of course. The result will be violent winds and turbulence. I estimate velocities of between 200 and 300 kilometers an hour. Incidentally, very much the same thing occurs on Earth. The heated air at the equator, which shares the Earth's 1600 kilometer an hour spin, runs into the same problem when it rises and flows north and south.
Ah, the trade winds. I remember that from my geography lessons.
Exactly, Sir Robert. Rama will have trade winds with a vengeance. I believe they'll last only a few hours, and then some kind of equilibrium will be restored. Meanwhile, I should advise Commander Norton to evacuate as soon as possible. Here is the message I propose sending.
With a little imagination, Norton told himself, he could pretend that this was an improvised night camp at the foot of some mountain in a remote region of Asia or America.
the clutter of sleeping pads, collapsible chairs and tables, portable power plant, lighting equipment, electrosan toilets, and miscellaneous scientific apparatus would not have looked out of place on Earth.